You're listening to audio from Pleasant Valley Community Church. For more information about Pleasant Valley, visit our website at pleasantvalley.cc.
All right, while we're passing around some plates, I want to just remind you, Pastor Jeremy just said via video that not next Friday, but the Friday afterward is our Good Friday service, April 14th. So it'll be at 7 p.m. Please come to that service. We have a great time. It's one of the most packed gatherings that we have during the year, our candlelight service and our Good Friday service. It's usually kind of full in here because we only have one gathering as opposed to three. And so make sure you show up early. Make some room for guests by setting up close in the front if you guys don't mind. And then also, as we've just mentioned, for the first time in 3 years, we're having our Easter gatherings here. It works better for children's ministry. Our guests get a chance to see what we do here. It feels a little bit more like a normal gathering for them. And so it's kind of strategic. And believe it or not, we're expecting about 1,300 people to gather on Easter here in our three services total. And yes, we can do that. The seating capacity that we have in this building allows for us to have that many people. We would just have to spread that out in all three services kind of uniquely. The Lord is going to have to give lots of grace there. So please, please, please come to the 11:30. Like, open Easter baskets or whatever it is that you do on Easter morning. Sleep in, go eat some Bob Evans, and come in and hang out with us at 11:30. In fact, not only is seating capacity a potential issue for us, even more than that, as we saw via video, parking is a much bigger deal. And so right now, we need 50 cars to commit to parking over in the flea market parking lot between 8th Street and Highway 60. So dads, you can drop off your family, roll over there, park, and walk over. We have to have 50 cars committed to park in all three services in order to even, like, physically possibly park and accommodate 1,300 people. And so I am praying that for those of you who decide to park in the flea market parking lot at the 11:30 service, that the Lord would give you a car, just bless you with it. He would just drop it in your lap. And so I'm praying, believing, no guarantees. Pleasant Valley is not responsible for any said car not received, but I'm praying that the Lord would anoint that and give it to you as a unique blessing. So try it out. You never know. So we need people to commit to parking. Please help us out. That would be an amazing way to serve. We're not asking that because we just want to see 1,300 people gathered in the same building, even though that's really cool. We're asking that because we know that people will come who don't normally gather with us, who need the message and the good news of Jesus, right? And so it's a really simple way for us to serve and to be on mission on a day where the whole world kind of gathers in one building. And so it's a unique opportunity. Let's seize it and do our best. It's a good time to teach your kids about being on mission and why you're parking so far away and why you're coming to the later service as opposed to the 10. I want to start off by telling you guys a story of two U.S. scientists who were studying in Peru in 1962. It was David Bernays and Charles Sawyer, and they discovered a glacier that was sitting on the edge of an extinct volcano that was very, very unstable. And so they proceeded to tell the government. They proceeded to tell the nearby cities. They were telling villages and cities. And they were really stirring up no small degree of panic. Everyone was kind of freaking out until they were promptly thrown in jail for stirring up so much panic. And they stayed there for 2 weeks until they were willing to recant publicly that there was really an unstable glacier on the side of this extinct volcano. Sounds like the opening to a movie where The Rock stars in it. But 8 years later, after ignoring their warning and their message, after totally dismissing them and forcing them to go to jail until they would recant, something terrible happened. A massive earthquake hit Peru of magnitude 7.8, and it shook this unstable glacier free from the mountain. As you guys can see, it was Glacier 511. That whole chunk of the top of that mountain dislodged and it slid down and covered the surrounding villages and cities, killing 70,000 people total in Peru with the earthquake. It was the largest avalanche in world history that we're aware of, and it was the deadliest avalanche in world history that we're aware of. It was a big deal. They say that the size of that glacier was roughly the size of two skyscrapers weighing 6 million tons, hurling toward the city at speeds that are just unimaginable. And so this city ignored the warning coming at them, and it cost them everything. Well, the Apostle Paul, who wrote this letter that we have been studying for about 2 years now, can relate in some ways to these two U.S. scientists. He was a man who carried very urgent news. He was a man who caused no small amount of chaos and controversy everywhere he went with his news. He was a man who was dismissed and persecuted and thrown into jail for proclaiming his news. And unlike the two U.S. scientists, he never recanted. But Paul didn't have just a message of impending danger. Rather, he had good news for a world that was already under the rubble of brokenness and sin and death. And he knew that they needed to hear the message and the good news of Jesus that would pull them out. And so Paul, during his three different journeys around the Eastern known world, carried the gospel and planted churches by making disciples. And really, essentially covered the entire known East with the good news of Jesus Christ during his life. And so for any of us, that would seem like enough. Like, wow, mission accomplished. That's an amazing feat, right? But not for Paul. He wasn't done. Paul committed to taking the gospel all the way to the West. In fact, one of the main reasons that Paul writes this letter to the Roman church was so that he could prepare them to be a missions hub or a center, sending center for the western part of the world, over in Spain, which is over to the west of that map that's not seen there. But he wants to plant in Rome and go west with the gospel and make that his sending center. Paul had never met these people. He didn't start this church, but he's kind of plowing from afar the hard soil with his spiritual hoe, trying to get the soil ready for Rome, for him to come and to begin to work with them. And so for the last nine chapters of this letter to Rome, Paul has been working in the soil. He's been hoping to unify a really highly divided group of Jew and Gentile believers, and he's hoping to see them bear fruit. And so this morning, I want us to see three things that Paul wanted to give the Roman church to get her ready to be this missions hub, so to speak. Okay? And the first thing that we see that Paul was doing is he was planting in Rome an absolute confidence in the gospel. Let's look at Romans 10. We're going to back up to verse 11 and then kind of get some momentum and go forward. I promise not to preach the same message that James preached last time. So Romans 11 through 13, he says, "Everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there's no distinction between Jew or Greek." Again, you kind of see his context here. He's speaking to a divided group. "For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord," what? "Will be saved." Paul, listen to Paul's confidence. He believes this. Paul is writing to a church half made up of pagans who've lived their lives spiritually in desperation and in fear of what might happen every day they wake up. These fickle pagan Greek gods could at any moment zap them with a lightning bolt or bless them to be their wife. You just never knew what was going to happen in Greek mythology. These people had lived their lives in grotesque sin. They had sold their lives. Surely they were carrying all of this weight of guilt and sin after practicing things that were unthinkable in the Christian faith. And yet here they are in this church, and Paul says, "Any of you that believe will be saved, and God will pour his riches out on you." The other half is a church made up of people who've lived their lives remembering curtains and boundaries and sacrifices and walls up that would say, "You can't come in here unless you're clean or you're holy." They've probably, from what we know about church history and what we see in the scriptures, distorted God's law and made some kind of sick legalism out of it. And Paul's speaking over them and saying, "No, any of you that confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, you will be saved." He lays flat all of the contenders in front of him with confidence and says, "Let's get unified behind this." So Paul knows that a gospel that saves all will ultimately unify all. So James spent the last 2 weeks covering those verses. I don't want to labor here. We're going to move on to point number two. Paul was planting in Rome an urgency for those who haven't heard. Let's look at verses 14 through the first half of 15, where he asks these series of questions. He says, "How will they call on him whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him in whom they've never heard? And how will they hear without someone preaching? And how will they preach unless they're sent? And so for you engineers in here, your antennas are peeking up. You're like, oh, he's reverse engineering from confession all the way to the beginning of the process. And so in order to help you guys, because I have this amazing gift of art, I made this little chart for you that we're going to look at, as you can tell. Hopefully you're not distracted by my giftedness of drawing and you're able to pay attention and to the sermon. But so Paul says, how will they confess if they haven't believed? And how will they believe unless they have heard? And how will they hear unless they have been preached to? And how will they be preached to unless they are sent? And I thought the little guys carrying the arrow was pretty impressive. I drew that out kind of first thing in preparation for this sermon. And that ultimately gives you the map of really what we're looking at here in this text. Why aren't people confessing? Well, it's because they haven't believed. And why haven't they believed? Well, it may be because they've never had anyone preach to them. They've never heard it. Why is no one preaching? Well, maybe Rome isn't sending anybody. You can kind of see Paul's intentions here with this Roman church. He's like, hey, look, people haven't heard. You guys got to send people out. And this dilemma of people not confessing Jesus is really the dilemma that drove the Apostle Paul's life. I am absolutely blown away at his conviction that everyone should have the opportunity to hear the good news. Everyone, without fail. He set out to reach every inch of the known world with Jesus, but even more than his conviction and belief that everyone should hear, but his faith that God was going to use him to see it actually happen. It's amazing. He knew with all of his heart that God had chosen him not just to try, but to succeed at reaching the entire known world to him with the good news of Jesus Christ. I remember sitting in a hotel floor in Laos with these group of men in an area where it's illegal to preach Jesus, who were planting churches all over Laos. And these were men, their faith was amazing. But I remember being struck by one man in particular. We were asking him how we can pray for him. And he responded with, well, I'm going to see a million people come to Jesus through this work. And so pray that God would continue to give me faith. And we're like, all right, bro. Yeah, that's really cute that you have big thoughts and big dreams. And he like stopped us in the middle of our giggling and was like, no, I'm going to see a million people come to Jesus. Pray for me. And so we stopped, we sobered up, and instead of mocking him, we admired his faith and got on board and prayed that God would give him what he was dreaming for, which was seeing that many people come to Jesus. It's that kind of faith that's contagious, and these men are amazing. That God-given faith drove Paul to accomplish unbelievable kingdom work. And I've got just a kind of a generic map here showing all of the places where Paul planted churches. From Acts 13 through all the way through chapter 1, Paul plants in 17 different locations, including the 7 churches that we see in the book of Revelation. He took about 2 to 4 years in the city of Ephesus to reach all of those places like Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Smyrna, Philadelphia, Laodicea, that section right there. And in Acts 19:10, Paul declares that everyone in Asia had heard the word of the Lord. He's like, well, I wanted everybody in Asia to hear the gospel, and they did. So I'm ready to move on to the next place. I can't imagine 2 to 3 years from now, being able to stand in front of you guys, we've been dedicated to reaching Northeast Thailand, and just standing in front of you and saying, hey guys, I think everybody in Thailand's heard the gospel, so good job. Where do you guys want to go next? And not only did he have this vision and this dream, but this is the Spirit of God speaking through Paul, and the Spirit recorded this for us. I don't think this is just him being silly. I think Paul really did reach all of what was known as Asia at the time with the word of Christ. He did it. So in a span of 10 to 12 years, Paul planted countless churches in 17 different locations, all in unreached, unengaged places with the message of Jesus. And guys, it's really hard to take the gospel into a place for the first time. It is laborious. It is difficult. There's so many cultural things you have to get over and get through. There was every obstacle in his way. And yet here he stands declaring to us 2,000 years later, we did it. None of this came easy for Paul. He wasn't just like walking into villages with a Holy Spirit magic wand and going, you know, that wasn't, I don't know that anyone's ever done this from the pulpit up here. I might be the first. But he wasn't just like zapping spots and then churches would just magically grow up from the ground. Like Paul, from the very beginning of his call in Acts chapter 9, Ananias, remember, spoke over him and said, he is my chosen instrument, Paul, to reach the Gentiles, and I will show him how much he must suffer for my namesake. You guys remember that? Well, that came into fruition. I mean, Paul was rejected. He was stoned. He was beaten with whips. You remember, like Jesus was when he was crucified? Paul was beaten that way 5 times. He was beaten with rods 3 different times. He was put in prison countless times. He was shipwrecked 3 times. He endured storms at sea. Dudes robbed him. He was accused by his own friends of wrong. People accused him of taking money for bad reasons. They didn't believe his message. His own friends shunned him. He was often hungry and naked and lonely. Paul gave up everything he had to see this thing happen. Some of y'all are dreaming, but you're not willing to sacrifice for the dream. Paul's a good example of a man who not only felt called by the Lord, but didn't sit around and wait for something to happen. He spilled his blood into the ground, and God blessed it and did these amazing things. And from what we understand from the history books, Paul made it to Spain. We don't get to see that in the scriptures spelled out a whole lot. We kind of see him end in Rome. But most historical accounts have some mention of Paul hanging out in Spain, and he made it. God gave him the fruit of what he desired. He got to see it. So Paul covered the entire known world with the gospel. It's amazing. I am personally a sucker for people who dream big and cast these crazy vision ideas. Like I'm just, you know, I'm like a fanboy for anybody who thinks they're going to do something stupid. I love crazy people who believe they can do anything. And that's why I'm a sucker for movies like that are set in the U.S.-Russian space race, you know, where we're going into the atmosphere for the first time and we're, you know, orbiting the Earth for the first time and we're going to the moon and let's try to go wherever. I'm all in on that kind of stuff. It can be a terrible movie and I'll sit through every second of it with my jaw dropped just because just thinking about being in that setting and saying, hey, let's go to space, it just blows me away. It's really cool stuff. This is another reason why Brad Rhodes is really dangerous for me, because Brad is one of these high vision, I'm going to change the entire country with, you know, his view on marriage guys. Like we're as pastors, we'll sit around a table and be like, what's our vision for the year? And I'll be like, I really want people to sing more at Pleasant Valley or whatever. And Brad will be like, I'm going to change the way the entire country thinks about the word marriage. I'm like, okay, awesome. Let's do it. And that's just how he's built. Brad could talk me into anything short of being a Duke fan if we're in the same room. Like every time he calls me, I'm just like ready and armed to go do something with him fun. So Brad's a crazy dreamer. Over the last 2 years, though, I've been looking intensely at Paul as a church planner for the first time, not just the guy who wrote all the cool theological stuff that I've grown up learning. But also as a planter, because I'm trying to plant churches in an area that's unreached like he was. And so I have just been unbelievably blown away by his gumption. This guy really believed that God had called him to reach the Roman Empire with the gospel. And Paul knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that God was going to let him see it happen. And God did. And today, for these last 2,000 years, the churches that he's planted have been toiling and working to the same end, trying to reach as many people with the gospel as we can. But we know, just based on the numbers, we have this kind of neat window now where we can see the world differently than anybody else has, that our world is very big, that the birth rates are astronomical. We're seeing more people born into this world than we ever have before. And populations are massive. And according to the Joshua Project, there are 7.2 billion people. This is a few years ago. And out of that 7.2 billion people, 3 billion people still have little to no access to the gospel. It just means that no one is trying to reach them. No one, they don't really see any reason at this point why they would have access to the gospel. And 1.6 to 2.4 billion people are completely unevangelized, which means there's not even a strategy in place by anybody to change that. No one's even trying. And there are approximately 16,500 unique people groups in the world. Just under 7,000 of them are considered unreached, which means they have less than 2% of their population evangelized, which is kind of the standard they give for a people group to have the amount of momentum and resource to reach itself. And so just under 7,000 of them they would consider not resourced well enough to reach themselves with the gospel, to promote the gospel within itself. 86% of all of these unreached people groups are inside the 1040 window. You guys know what the 1040 window is? It's this rectangular spot that includes like Saharan Africa, Northern Africa, and most of Asia. And 2/3 of the world's population lives inside this window, which is just amazing to think about. 2/3 of the world's population is right there. And they're made up of Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and atheists, animists and Jews. And this is one of the main reasons why we decided to adopt the Thai Nha people in Northeast Thailand. As you guys can see, like, they're located right in that window. It's really strategic for us to reach those people, because we want something to catch fire in that region and spread. Let me read verses 14 and 15 again in light of what we just learned. How will they call on him if they've not believed? And how will they believe in whom they've never heard? And how will they hear without someone preaching? And how will they preach unless they've been sent? Now, normally, as the missions guy, like, this is the point of the sermon where I begin to lay it on really heavy on you guys and make you feel guilty for not having gotten on a plane and flown directly into the 1040 window. As my pastor Sean Madden used to say, like, he always recruited dudes who would parachute into hell with a water pistol. You know, like, he wanted that group. Like, why haven't you gone? This is the point of the sermon where I would make you feel bad, where we would all recite the Isaiah missionary plea, like, here I am, Lord, send me, right? I want to take a little bit of a different approach, though. Number one, because I don't think that works very well, because we tend to be glossed over really quick and forget that guilty feeling that we feel sitting in a room. And I want to take just a minute to show you what God is doing all over the world. And here's the truth, guys. God is going to finish his work. If the U.S. church never wakes up, gets off her butt and starts to get into to unreached peoples, God's going to do it. If Pleasant Valley never gets off her butt and sits around and just kind of hangs out, God's still going to do it. If you don't get up, or me, if neither of us get up and jump into the work, God will accomplish his mission. And here's the thing. He is accomplishing his mission. We're not losing this battle. I want to show you guys some numbers from all around the world. Right now, every single day, 174,000 new believers are added to the church. Did you guys know that? Over the last 10 years, there have been 300 million people who've come to Jesus. And guys, here's the catcher. Like, right now, that 174,000, that's a lot higher number than over the last 10 years. That 10-year mark was about 82,000 per day, so the number is significantly growing, almost more than doubled up to this point over 10 years. And out of that 300 million people, 290 of them are located, guess where? The 1040 window. Most of the people coming to Jesus are in that hard-to-reach spot, that unreached spot. Did you know that in India there are 15,000 people baptized every single month and that there are nearly 50 million Christians? Did you guys know that in China, there are 30, and I double-checked this as many times as I could, there are 30,000 Chinese people coming to Jesus every single day. And that there are just under 80 million people confessing Jesus Christ today in China. In fact, by 2030, China will become the largest Christian hub in the whole world. It's not percentage, but that's just total number of Christians, 230 million Christians by 2030. If nothing else changes, if things just keep going the way that they are. Did you guys know that more Muslims have come to Christ since I was born than in the last 30, the last 1,000 years combined? More Muslims, places like Iran and Afghanistan. African Muslims are coming to Jesus in droves. It is amazing what God is doing. So that's a big picture, lots of big numbers. Let's narrow that in and talk about two examples that I want to show you guys just to put some more meat on those bones. There was a man named Ying Kai who in the early 2000s set out to plant churches in China. This is a picture of him. After praying and seeking God and talking with his mission sending organization, they had decided that God had laid it on Ying Kai's heart to try to plant, I think it was 200 churches and see 18,000 people come to Jesus. Those are big dreams, right? I mean, that's massive. So after 3 months on the ground, Ying Kai calls his mission sending organization and they get this panicked phone call and he's like, I've got a problem. And they're like, what's your problem, Ying? He's like, well, I've already reached my 10-year goal and we're 3 months in. Like, what do I do now? And so they were like, keep going. Don't stop. And by the end of his first year, he saw 53,430 people baptized and started 3,535 new churches. This is recent history, guys. This guy's still around doing conferences and stuff. Like, this guy, and so let me define church real quick. We don't mean 3,500 of these, specifically like in buildings with a paid pastor and all these things. What we mean is these are groups of people gathered together either in a building or in a home somewhere in their city, probably a 15 or to 20 on average. Who are studying the Bible, who are sharing their resources, who have defined leadership, who are taking the Lord's Supper and they're baptizing people. They're on mission together. They're just the church, right? They're just bare minimum, bare bones church. And these kinds of churches are spreading like wildfire, especially in places of persecution all over the world. And so in year two, Ying Kai saw 104,500 baptized. Almost 10,000 churches. By year 10, Ying had witnessed 1,738,143 documented and vetted baptisms and planted 158,993 churches. Whoa, right? Guys, that's happening. Has anybody ever heard that before? Why? Like, why don't we as Christians have like flags and billboards and stuff up everywhere saying, yo, we're winning? Right? That's exciting. To bring that home even a little bit more personally, Mark Hamschult is a man that I've traveled personally to Thailand with on a number of occasions. He is the one who is our partner with E3 Partners, who is connected to Passion. He's our connection to Passion. And he's the one who's been training us on how to do these house church movement principles in Northeast Thailand. Well, he kind of got good at this in India, where he jumped in with a bunch of locals who were crazy in Mumbai, India. And so they started in 2011, and their goal was to plant 44,000 churches in the 44,000 villages in Mumbai, which represented 123 million people. So the 123 million is the total population of Mumbai. So they set out to plant churches in 2011. They had this 2020 vision where they wanted to plant 44,000 churches by 2020. And in 2011, they planted 41. 2012, they planted 93. 2013, 300. As of today, they have seen 1 million people gathering in homes, identifying as over 50,000 churches in India. It's incredible. These are men with Apostle Paul-like dreams who really believe that they can mess up an entire continent with Jesus. God, would you raise up more? By the way, if you're that dreamer, crazy person, and you're in this church, don't let people tell you that you can't do things that are crazy. Tell them to shut up and pray more, right? So if you're that person and you've ever felt like we've shoved you to the side or we've dismissed what God has planted in your heart, we're sorry. Don't let us do that. Press on. Be like Paul. Do crazy stuff. And we'll celebrate you and be as much on board with you as we possibly can. So God, would you free up more apostolic leaders, those type of men who go, who carry the message, who plant churches, who cause movement in Owensboro. So the world has never grown at this rate since its birth at Pentecost. Things are moving faster than they ever have. And like Paul, it's cost the blood, sweat, and tears and freedom and lives of many. But I'm convinced that God is working in such an amazing way today that all of the historically awesome missionaries, if they could like have a heaven phone and beam down and like send you a text message or give you a call, they'd say, "Hey, stupid, wake up. Like, crazy stuff is going on," and they're jealous right now because, I mean, William Carey, the founder and father of modern missions, I mean, dude saw one convert in 6 years in India. It took him 6 years to see the first person bow the knee to Jesus, and you guys just saw what had happened since 2011. Same span, 6 years, 1 million people. It's incredible. God is moving uniquely today. So, you know what? I'm not going to guilt you guys into doing something that you don't want to do. I don't really have to. I'm not going to try to get you on a plane. What I am going to do, though, is beg you to open your eyes and to worship God for his power and his presence all over the world. God is doing crazy stuff. Thank him. Enjoy him. God is planting movements in the hardest places in the world in spite of our butts being firmly planted on our couch. So I'm going to ask you this. Why wouldn't you want to be a part? I'm going to ask you this. Why are you content in not getting a piece of the conquer the world for Jesus pie? You're like, "Nah, bro, I'm good." You're just going to sit away from the table and not eat that stuff? That it looks like good pie, right? So will the richest so-called Christian nation in the world just sit by while God turns the whole world upside down? Are we just going to like do nothing? Will we be content to watch as Koreans and Chinese and Mongolians reach the world? By the way, Mongolia sends more missionaries now per capita than any other country in the world, a place that was desperately unreached just like 20 or 30 years ago. Here at PVCC, we want a piece of the pie. We want to be a part of what God's doing. And so if you want to join us, then you can let us know right now. It's a real practical step forward into this, into international missions and reaching unengaged people groups. There's a Connect card in front of you. Take it and write, "I want some pie" on the bottom. I mean, if that's weird. I think it is. Like, write just international missions on there or just email me. My email address is in the bulletin. Pastor Brandon. I'd love to hear from you and we'll get you going. It doesn't mean you're getting on a plane tomorrow. It just means you're going to take the first step. Maybe it's just praying. Maybe it's learning to share the gospel with your neighbors. Because all of us are called to that, right? Sharing the gospel with the people around us, whether it's in our home or neighborhood or it's the farthest reaches of the world. All of us need to be obeying Jesus' commission to make disciples, baptizing them and teaching them all that Christ commanded, right? So let's all get better at that. Let's all obey Jesus. Let's all take steps forward. We'd love to help. So if you're willing to do that, you're willing to be sent, you're willing to grow as a disciple maker, well, Paul has a really unusual compliment for you. He says, "Your feet are beautiful." So how many of y'all are kind of grossed out by feet? Raise your hand. Like, you can say it. It's cool. Like, all right, a lot more than the 10. 8:30, they're kind of weird. They all like feet. So a lot of you guys are kind of like, yeah. How many of y'all are sitting next to somebody right now who has stinky feet? Like, it's okay. Yeah. Yeah, I see a few. Yeah, I see that hand. In biblical times, feet were really, like, not cool. It was dirty. You know, we call them Jesus sandals for a reason. People were wearing these like, little strapped footwear that didn't protect their feet from dirt and grime and things on dusty, nasty roads where, you know, animals were carted around and left their stuff everywhere. And people would come into homes and take their shoes off and it was just feet were gross. And I imagine they probably didn't have great toenail clippers and lots of good foot hygiene back then. So it's just, you know, everything that's coming to mind right now is probably what it was like. And so they were kind of a symbol of what's wrong with sin and humanity. And in fact, even to this day, if you show the bottom of your foot towards someone or something, it's offensive. It's like giving it the bird, essentially. It's not helpful. So as a white guy going into Thailand, sitting on a floor, like, you got to be super careful about where you point your heels. It's pretty tough for guys like Tanner who are, 6'4" to not prop his feet up on somebody. But Paul says here in this context, in this world, of people who share the gospel, he says, how beautiful, this is verse 15, are the feet of those who preach the good news. He's quoting Isaiah chapter 52 here, and Isaiah was addressing God's people who were being crushed by the Assyrians. And so God was sending messengers to pronounce their deliverance from Assyria here in this context. In fact, the actual verse says, how beautiful, this is Isaiah 52:7, are upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings news of happiness, who publishes salvation. As we know, God was sending a message of deliverance to Israel, but not just Israel. This was a prophecy. This is smack dab in the middle of the suffering servant passage where Jesus is beaten and striped and bruised for our healing, right? And so we know ultimately the feet that were ultimately going to carry peace into this world from the mountain of God were the very feet of God. They were the feet of Jesus. And when I hear this text, my mind immediately runs to the story of the woman in Luke chapter 7 who with her tears washes Jesus' feet and with her hair dries his feet. You remember Simon the Pharisee is all mad and miffed because this weird adulterous woman is coming in and touching the feet of Jesus, and his feet are dirty and nasty, and he's kind of mad. But this woman knew something that this Pharisee didn't. She knew that these feet carried good news to the broken. She knew that these feet were publishing peace and salvation. She understood that these feet were precious and that they were beautiful. I also picture Jesus kneeling at the feet of his disciples with a towel around his waist and a basin in front of him, kneeling at the feet of these men that he's lived his life with right before he died. Remember, he washed their feet. And that's gross. And Peter was even like, no way, God, don't do that. But these feet were beautiful. And they were created and set aside by Jesus himself to carry the good news of God all into the world. Paul here wanted to make Rome a sending hub for the Western world. He wanted to make a factory for beautiful feet. He's trying to unify this divided church around one gospel and one mission. And lastly, Paul is planting in the Roman church a resilience to Jewish persecution. Because even as these beautiful feet carry the good news of God into the world, many reject Christ's message, right? Some of you guys this morning will reject Christ's message. I'm not saying that I have beautiful feet. Some of you will not obey. And Paul, knowing that this is a reality in Romans 10:16, says, but they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah also, this is Isaiah just a few verses later in Isaiah 53, verse 1, it says, Lord, who has believed what we've heard? God, who's going to believe this good news that you're telling me right now? Nobody's going to believe me. And you know what? A lot of people didn't. And Paul knows that historically, and he's citing Isaiah here saying, remember, a lot of Jewish people didn't believe Isaiah's good news. A lot of Jewish people rejected Jesus when he came and his disciples. And so probably they're going to reject our news too. And he goes on to kind of just dissect this a little bit in Romans 10:18. And he asks the question rhetorically, is it because they haven't heard? He answers himself. He says, no. He quotes Psalm 19 here and says, their voice has gone out all over the earth in their words to the end of the world. He's reminding them of Psalm 19 where God was making his glory known all over the earth and no one is left with an excuse, right? And Paul's saying, well, and not only is God shining his glory and power all over the world, I'm pretty much telling everybody in the whole world about Jesus. I know they've heard because I was in the synagogue telling them. So he's kind of connecting those two things. It's God's intention to shower the world with the gospel in the same way that it's covered with God's glory. Someone had been sent. Someone had preached. Israel had heard, and they still were not believing. They weren't confessing. Paul follows that up even further by asking in Romans 10:19, is it because Israel didn't understand? And then he quotes two passages from the Old Testament. He quotes both Moses and Isaiah in Romans 10:19 through 20. He says, first, Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I'll make you angry. And Isaiah is bold as to say, I have been found by those who didn't seek me. I have shown myself to those who didn't even ask for me. And so the gospel message is so simple that, I know this is kind of offensive because this is all us, these foolish pagan people are being converted right in front of Jewish people, and they're getting it. So it's not that it's too hard to understand. Even the pagans get it, right? God has shown himself to even those who weren't seeking after him. Paul is arguing to the Jews, even Gentiles are coming to Christ. And this is exactly what God had planned all along. And he points to these two prophecies where God was going to raise up the Gentiles to make the Jews both look foolish and to make them jealous of what he was doing in the world because they rejected his Messiah. So imagine being a Jewish believer in Rome and how difficult it would be under the heavy weight of condemnation of your peers. Trusting in Christ, meeting with these Gentiles in a church, giving up some of the things that they've held on to their whole life. Imagine being a pagan believer here in Rome and being surrounded by persecution and being potentially stoned or losing your life because there are people who hate the message of Jesus. And Paul is saying to them, roll on right through and over all of that because that's what Jesus did. He's just preparing them. Look, guys, people aren't going to believe, and it's not the message's fault. It's because they're stubborn. So what is God's response to these unrepentant and stubborn people? Does he stand up and wash his hands of them? Does he move on to people who are more willing and ready to receive? Well, no. Paul here answers that by quoting one more Old Testament verse. He says in Romans 10:21, he says, of Israel, he says, all day long, I've held out my hands to a disobedient and a contrary people. Guys, God never ceases to hold his hands out in willingness to receive anyone who would come to him. We believe that here with all of our hearts. There is never a point where God puts his hands down. They're always out. They were always inviting any that would come to him. The patience of the Lord, it never fails. The love of God, it is everlasting. It never stops. He will always be found by those who seek him. Amen? Always. So if you're here today, and you've heard the good news, someone's been sent, someone's preached, you've heard, but you haven't believed. Maybe you've believed, but you just haven't confessed. God is not willing that you should perish, but he holds his arms out to you for the thousandth time that you've heard the good news. He hasn't put his arms down. He hasn't stopped being willing to invite you into the family. He can be found. Come to him today. Trust in him today. Pray that that same gospel that Paul had confidence in and that wrecked the entire Roman Empire, the same gospel that is flourishing in China and India would become real to you this morning, that you would believe with all your heart and that you would trust in him. Today we're going to end our services with a meal. And if you guys want to come on up, it's a special meal. It was given to us by God himself to remind us of his love and what it cost him to redeem us and to wash away our sins. And so we're going to pass around two elements. One, we're going to pass around some bread that is used to symbolize Jesus' broken body for you. We're also going to pass around some juice. It's red. It's the color. It reminds us of blood, of the blood of Jesus that was spilt that washes away our sins. This meal is only for people who are trusting in Christ. It's only for the people who are believing and confessing Jesus today. But instead of this being something that pushes you away, we want to invite you to the table. Would today be the first day that you can take of this meal? Because you're trusting and you're repenting and you're believing in Jesus. Would you come today to the table? God is inviting you to come. So let's take just a minute. Let's pray and we'll sing and we'll take the Lord's Supper as we end.